The theme for the afternoon talk is the mindfulness of action. As you can see, the camera has just been set up, so from time to time the talks are recorded and time to time they're filmed as well. And the outcome is that occasionally some clips go up on YouTube, which I prefer to call I, Me and My Tube. And hence the camera there. The teachings deeply explore the importance of action, of human beings' activities in the world. I would like to relate it as much as possible to our meditations and our practices, and to look at the dynamic of action, our relationship to it, and where it may be necessary for us to explore, to give real attention to, and the benefits of that exploration. In the teachings, the word karma, in the Sanskrit K-A-R-M-A, in the Pali K-A-M-M-A, is action, and it's an action which is specifically supported with some kind of volition or intentionality. And when we look at ourselves and our inner experiences, what we experience at times, but not all the time, are certain kinds of actions which are taking place inside of ourselves. Any kind of movement in the inner life is an activity, it is an action. Sometimes that movement which takes place affects the general state of mind, of course. It also and equally has an impact on speech, what we say, feelings and attitude and tone that goes with it. And it also has an impact on the body and the body engaged, what we do in this world. So there is an activity which takes place. It moves through perceptions and feelings. It enters into thoughts and speech and writing, of course, and activity. And there are, in those fields of activity, two kinds which are of great importance for human beings, for all of us. One is the unhealthy. And the unhealthy movement moves through, it affects us, it affects other people, of course, and the world that we live in. And when that movement takes place, in a kind of old language a little bit, it's called the unwholesome or unhealthy karma. So there's an activity, and what is unhealthy within us cannot possibly come from the healthy. So when we express something, when we're in anguish, angry, fearful, blaming and agitated, it has to come from that. It's not that it can come from something other than that. Blame cannot come from non-blame. Greed and selfishness cannot come from non-greed and non-selfishness. Fear and confusion cannot come from non-fear and non-confusion. So, in the addressing of our experience inwardly, we endeavour to look at what is taking place, to recognise the activities which are taking place, and rather importantly here, to pick up and notice clearly those which are unhealthy and those which are healthy, which I'll come to in a moment. So in the unhealthy movement that goes on, knowing ourselves, atma, self, vidya, knowing, the knowing of our self is an ongoing life process, and it would be a foolish and arrogant human being who can claim I know myself. There is so much in the depth of the being, and quite often the consciousness is a rather small area, and there is a tremendous amount of the being. And when events come together, the inner events, they mold together, they form together, and sometimes there is a friction. Understand the word friction? A tension, a rubbing. And this rubbing together, this friction in the human being, gives the appearance of a self. The self, that is I, the me and the my, is a rubbing in the inner life which attaches or connects or gets caught in the movement. It's called greed, it's called negativity, it's called worry, it's called fear, it's called blame. And this process goes on inside of us. And as I mentioned, sometimes and frequently in various ways manifesting out there in the world. So it's quite an undertaking to look at the inner world, which is as rich and as vast and as deep as anything out there. But what we sometimes find is our life is so much pulled towards the outer via the senses that there is the push inside and we constantly go outward. That not only applies to much socializing, but even those women and men who might live alone, spend a lot of time alone, and perhaps enjoy and appreciate being alone, doesn't mean to say that the aloneness carries with it any inner inquiry. It's simply a separation from the social. So the inner work is to really look, what is these activities which takes place inside of me and which manifests in consciousness in different ways. What is extraordinary about this, and I think the Buddha's teachings on this are vitally important, and that is to understand this process in a way free from, it's not easy, from the sense that this is me, this is myself, and this is who I am. So in the friction within the tension inside of us with the unhealthy or the problematic, the tension creates or generates the idea, this is me, this is myself, this is who I am. And the stronger the friction, the stronger the view. A common example of epidemic proportions, it probably gets mentioned every single day without exception to teachers, and that is the friction of the self, which is the self actually, and what it connects with, let's say blame, easily and frequently turns on itself. It has to. The persistent regularity of human beings constantly putting ourselves down, feeling inside of not being good enough, lack of self-worth, an intensity of comparing ourselves with other, and this finding fault with ourselves, as if we were some weird, what should we say, aberration of existence, quite forgetting that we are human. And the meeting, the friction called the self, and the negative, it lands inside of us, and we believe in it very strongly, and it is clearly one of the hardest voices that human beings have to deal with. As the Buddha commented on this, he said, there is nobody on this earth who gives us such a hard time as we give ourselves. And we wonder, how on earth, is just the question here, how on earth is it that I, so-called, who am with myself, so-called, day in and day out, also so-called, there, how could it be such a situation where I treat myself so badly, I am so disrespectful towards myself, I am unable to love myself, feel friendship for myself, and I have become so terrifyingly reliable on the approval of others to feel good about myself when they don't feel good about themselves? What opportunity is it for them who don't feel good about themselves to find something to feel good about yourself? If it's not too complicated, you get the point. So here I am, caught in this situation, and what is sad about it, if I haven't explored this, if I haven't found softness and kindness, I will find myself reacting to this self-blame, to this putting down of myself, and doing everything to feel good about myself. And the more I do, that willpower and that striving and effort, it exhausts me, I get tired, I get weak, and I find myself, despite all my efforts to feel good about myself, feeling miserable. I'm in the loop. And this loop is a nightmare. Life is constant, becomes a constant effort to feel good about oneself. And it is such a phenomena, this process, that sometimes I want to escape from it. I think in the EU, 1 in 10 people regularly, in the course of a year, have suicidal thoughts. It's that serious a situation. That the pressure which is there, all of it, how quickly and easily I take it very personally. It's about me, it's about I, it's about my life. And Buddha's Dharma is asking, maybe pleading with us, don't see it personally. It's a process. It's an event which is taking place. The more I believe in it as personal, when it clearly can't be personal, because who gets up and goes through the day and says, I just can't wait to feel more miserable. I just want to be unhappy. I want to feel depressed. Nobody in there, with a little whisper of clarity, thinks like that. So there is this event which is going on. And sometimes, in the anguish and the pain of it, we may look into the past, but if we go into the generalities, it will not help. And if the generality is, oh, it's my family, it doesn't help. It's more likely to feed it. If it goes into my culture, Jewish in this case, it doesn't help. If it goes into the Holocaust, if it goes into the last 3,000 years or more, when I listen, and my God, I've listened a lot here, I can tell you 20 years, the feeling that I get, it's become an excuse. It's the using of the past to stop change. I am like this, we are like this, and there is a tragedy of human determinism about this makes me like this. And if one holds to that view, there is no hope for change. There's no liberation. There's no love. There's no empowerment. There's no transformation. Because the view has identified so strongly with it, it becomes an excuse for change. Oh, us are like this because of. It's not to say that there is no truth in it. It's not to say there isn't history. And it's all rather impersonal. We didn't even ask to be born in the family that we were born in, and most of us would have chosen another one very quickly if we had any choice about it. So even that birth is completely non-self, non-personal. When I arrive as a human being into this particular condition, which we call ourselves, yes, I can recognize some of these influence of what was, but the key empowerment is what is going to change inside of me, that in those changes which take place, I am no longer a prisoner to the past. Because there's an English word for a prisoner to the past, and who believes it? It's called a victim. It's a dreadful identity to have. I get the whispers. Speak up, Christopher. Okay. So, just to repeat the last sentence. If I identify with the past as determining my present, there, the identity which is arising in the feeling sorry for ourselves is the victim. It's a very problematic identity. It contributes to unhappiness and depression. So to free the being up, I must hold, so to speak, rather lightly the past in order to explore the present. So I'm not rejecting it. There's a phenomena of... Oh, I keep moving away from the mic, sorry. There's a phenomena which takes place as well. And the Buddha, in one of his countless conversations, and it's also a reminder... here on the retreat and elsewhere, of the dynamics of the experience of human beings and how impersonal it is. And he gives four rather clear examples of this, and possibly some of us in the time here will be noticing it. He says, sometimes we experience the fruits of what we have done. Some of you have been speaking to us, and you say to me, and I'm sure other good teachers here too, Christopher, I'm completely wiped out. I'm burnt out. I've got no energy left. All I've got the energy left to do is to fantasize and daydream. And it's terribly boring. This happened to me in the past. And right now, in the present, I'm really upset. I'm really angry. The teachers received a lovely note this morning from somebody who was, in the English, really pissed off with the three of us. And that's an understatement with what was, well, English understatement to what actually was written. And so sometimes there is the action, the movement, and it must come out in various ways. Buddha said in this conversation, he said, when you are experiencing the fruits of something, unhealthy, unwholesome, whatever it might be, can you say to yourself, I don't think I have them now, the outcome, the consequences of what I've done, I don't think I'd experience them now. I'm not ready. I'll wait 2 or 3 days or when I go and see my therapist. The Buddha didn't say that, but you know what I mean. So sometimes the activities, I'm talking about the difficult, unhealthy addictions, habits and patterns, whatever they may be, sometimes they bear fruit. That's a foul-tasting fruit. There, the consequences arrive now. One cannot say to these consequences, no, now's not the right time. No, this anguish, this obsessive story I'm going through, it's not the right time, I'll wait till after the retreat. It lands. In the middle of anguish, frustration and pain, the Buddha asked, when you're in the middle of it, can you say to yourself, I'll drop it and I'll have a really happy, glorious, wonderful experience instead. I feel better about that one. Is the inner life going to take any notice? No. The authority says that. Can you say, actually, my meditation's really good today. I'm having a great practice. And all those problematic issues of my life, all that stuff, right? Yes, I'm ready. Okay, please come, because I've really finally got myself ready for all this incredible history. I'll take it now, because I'm ready for it. And you'll sit and walk a day. Well, come on, I'm ready. Why isn't it coming up? There. So some, and then the Buddha asked, so this, as you see, the extraordinary non-self situation of the human being with our choices. And the other one, it arises. It's painful, it's difficult, it's unresolved, it's something going on in our day-to-day life. And we say, no, this is finished. Stop. Give me peace. Stop. Is the other life going to say, oh, yeah, right, okay, I'm going. Bye. No. So we don't have the choice for when the stuff lands in the present. We don't have the choice to postpone it for the future. We don't have the choice to say, right, I'm really ready for it. It can come up now. This is the best moment for me because I'm on a retreat and Stephen and Leela are around, etc. And we don't have the choice just to say, enough, finish, over, been there, done that. No. So human beings in this non-self process, in this situation of the friction with the issues of the friction with the issues of life, sometimes we recognize and appreciate how little control we have, yet, and as repeated here, enough potential in the human being still to explore what is present. That consciousness, to be conscious, has the capacity to address what is present. And apart from seeing the impersonal, changing nature of things, it's not enough, most of the time, there are exceptions. We sometimes have too much faith in mindfulness, too much faith in observing or being with, or that other dreaded word, acceptance, there. And rather, if something is repeating itself, you've had the experience before today, you had it last week, you had it in similar ways in the past for you. When something emerges from the deep inside the human being, it's the clearest signal, and it can't get any clearer, it's the clearest signal that in its emergence it is saying, for God's sake, change. We are deluding ourselves. We don't have to do it for God's sake. I don't even believe in God, but I just like the language. We delude ourselves. If we imagine that it's arising and it's passing, in the moment or in the day or in the hour is somehow its resolution. It may just pass away because there's something more interesting stuff to come up to replace it. So we just want to notice in our meditations, and this is the part of the action, what in the experiences which are arising, what is the change which is necessary? It might be one or two or three things, and trust me, we need to be clear about it. Don't exaggerate the importance of meditation in terms of mindfulness and concentration and watching those boring sensations as some kind of answer to everything. It's helpful. It's a contribution. It's genuinely useful. But it needs to be accompanied as well with, if something is repeating and you know it's unsatisfactory, and you know it's a process that's going on, then equally to know what is the change that has to be applied and therefore practiced. Habits, tendencies, patterns, addictions. And that may need the good support of others as well. We shouldn't demand we can do it all by ourselves. And to set that kind of process going, to get that moving. If, for example, the thought has been arising, I know it has because I've been speaking to you, I'm working too much, and then you continue working, the karma of working too much will give you more pain as time goes by because you've not resolved that karma of working too much. What else is too much? The Buddha used a nice metaphor. He said, quite often in life with human beings, the root, strong metaphor here, the root is poisonous, and the fruit, the top, is honey-tipped. And what is meant by that, sometimes you and I will start something, and I've got, you know, God, hundreds of things. What you don't need me to give the list. Gambling, sex, making money, smoking, alcohol, drugs, and the full catastrophes. That sometimes the initial is honey-tipped. Whatever. Food, of course, that pilgrimage to the refrigerator. But the honey-tip has got a poisonous root in it. When we keep repeating the history, it becomes painful. It has to. Starts off nice, pleasant, but it ends up painful. And it's our meditations here and our practices here. Can I notice clearly there, is there anything in my life which started off honey-tipped and is now painful? To be quite clear about the specific, really mindful, clearly acknowledging there, and equally to see what is going to make the change. And quite often, the word sacrifice in the older tradition, and the Buddha moved away from the old forms of sacrifice, their animals and all that stuff, and said the sacrifice, in a way, is saying, what is it I need to do less of? That's the sacrifice. What is it that I need to do less of or stop totally in order to free up the being? That question is a pretty big question for all of us. What is it I need to do less of in order to free up the human being. And to put it the other way, I haven't forgotten about that healthy, wholesome, don't go away, I'll get there, maybe. What is it that I need actually to cultivate, to develop? If I am a fearful person, what ways can I develop fearlessness? If I am a fault-finding person, what ways can I develop friendship? If I am a greedy person, what way can I develop generosity or giving? So the process of the inner, sometimes the question is, what is radically different from that? What's the opposite to that? There. In the exploration of the inner life, the recognition of the, shall we say, non-difficult world matters deeply, deeply. The recognition of the non-difficult world matters deeply. If a person, if you, find yourself constantly concentrating in retreats, in your conversations, in your thoughts, on what is difficult, the tough, hard side of life, the very wishing to resolve this will perpetuate it. Understand? If I keep going on about what's wrong with me and how I need to change, and I go on and on and on and burn out all my friends for going on, apart from the three of us, that if I keep going on and on, the very view, even with the intention to make a change, actually feeds it. I'm saying I want to change, but I've got a habit of going over it and over it. Therefore, the recognition of the healthy inside the human being is essential. It's an indispensable practice feature. And therefore, the warmth, happiness, lightness, friendship must come, must be recognized. And that helps to show within us that which is healthy and wholesome, which still brings its fruits and its benefit. So we've been touching upon here. And the Buddha, who was, prior to his awakening, was a masochist of the highest order. Do you know what masochist is? What's the Pali? Eh? A masochist is a person who hates themselves, is constantly beating themselves up, is constantly causing themselves pain. And as a yogi in some of this 6-year period, he was a spiritual masochist. Some turn up on retreats, I have to say. And then there was one of those precious and small moments of illumination there, this recollection. And it was a recollection of when he was young under the tree, and being calm and happy, no demand on the world. And he asked himself, really precious question. Some of us should ask ourselves this. He said to himself, why am I afraid to be happy? And sometimes we are so used to the dark, to the difficult, that when The happiness comes in all of its magical and mysterious ways. We don't give it the respect that it deserves. Well, it's not real. It's just a moment. Somebody says something beautiful to us. Nah, they don't mean it. What do they want? So, when happiness comes through the love and appreciation from the other, a precious moment, the face of beauty, the lovely flower, the trees, the excellent food, and much else, those experiences are the points of illumination. The Buddha said, this happiness is the way to liberation. It is the touch of it and the sweetness of it. And that may come in subtle forms for us. Sometimes we wonder, with the deep depth of meditation, that in the quietness of the being, the recognition, the silences and the stillnesses, and one important area of this, and a very important one, is getting a perspective on the place of thought in human life. Getting a perspective on the place of thought in human life. And I think it's a particular issue in our, put it politely, overeducated. We know far too much about things which truly do not matter one bit. Some of us are appalled when we have misfortune to watch one of these quiz programs on the television there, and they ask the guest or the panel or the player, whatever, a certain general knowledge question. You've probably also been unlucky enough to watch some of these programs. And you watch, and then you find, one feels incredible shame, that one can actually answer these questions. And I ask myself, where did that come from? I had no interest in that subject. No interest in that information. It's got no relevance whatsoever to my life. And then one can answer two or three questions in a row. My God, it's a nightmare. And then they pay people off for answering the questions. They should be taking the money from them. Sorry about that. So there's all this knowledge and thoughts and words and information. It's pouring into us day in and day out. And therefore, it may well be, and we may have to ask ourselves, can I have the quiet discipline, in the nice sense, not the intense sense? The word for discipline in the Pali is vinaya, but the literal meaning is actually vinaya, is to turn away from. And again, with knowledge and information there, and all the resources that we have created, you know, this huge internet, we'll need an internet for the internet soon, the way it goes on. Can I, to find some genuine inner space and to allow something to move deeply, can I cut down on my information overload? Can I use discernment, which is also a meaning of the word viveka that Leela spoke to us about, can I employ and have the capacity and the quiet authority in myself at times to say no, no thank you? To remember, if it's radio and television, there is an on switch and there is an off switch. People remember the on and forget the off. And similarly, with what we read. Am I I've never played a computer game in my life. Probably because I wouldn't know how to play the thing. But anyway, so some people find themselves in the world of the games and much else. Can I, with all the stimulation that's coming, and often not very healthy, with all that stimulation, can I say no to that, reduce it dramatically in my life, in order to feel, in order to start feeling the deep? And if you and I have too much information, too much computer, too much computer games, too much media, too much going in, it's filling up the mind at the cost of the heart. And is it any wonder people, men and women, report, wow, sometimes I feel kind of dry inside. So in order to create the space that the renunciation, the letting go, the cutting down, getting a perspective on things, will allow something to move which is a fresh way of thinking, which are new ways of seeing. It won't happen without renunciation. Because if there's no renunciation, no letting go going on, our condition will have to go on just as it was before. And there's the wish and the expiration for love to come through, the happiness to come through, the incredible creative idea and the passion for it to come through. And our silences and our stillnesses make possible for that to emerge. And how am I going? 2 more minutes, promise. Well, maybe 2, 3. In awakening, it's not easy to understand. Well, before was probably not easy, but this is definitely not easy. In awakening of the heart and the mind and speech and body, it is a freedom from the karma. So quite a lot of activity, not all. Sometimes the volitions and the intentions are unhealthy, unwholesome for ourselves and others. We have the responsibility to address it. We do not put it off. You say, this needs to be looked at. It needs to be changed, and my God, I'm going to look at it, I'm going to change this and find real ways, and I'm going to be totally dedicated to it, out of respect for yourself and for others. We look at that which is healthy and wholesome. You say, my gosh, this is, brings something beautiful out of the human being. I'm going to be committed to this. And the Buddha said, it's a great, well, many great sentences, this is 5-star from my point of view, there he said, we do not do something because others out there tell us to do it. And I've got here violence and war and competitiveness and all the stuff that goes on in this mad world. We do not do something because others tell us to do it. We do something because it is healthy and skillful and sensitive. It is wholesome. It is non-harming. That's why we do it. We're not just going to live this life as second-hand creatures with these institutions, and Buddhism included here, these institutions telling us what to do. We look deep into our being and we will ask and question, what is causing anguish? Can we change that? What is precious and significant and cultivate and develop that and trust in that? No matter how many oppositional voices there are to it, this is why we do it. And then he goes on, I'm trying not to go on. I can go on and on, trust me. Then he says, both have a karma there. So there's the unhealthy karma there. Means volitional intentions and actions and the consequences. And there is the healthy, the development of that which is precious and beautiful in life, love and joy and compassion and inner peace and much, much else that can come. But then he doesn't leave us, and we don't leave ourselves, with, as it were, so to speak, trying to be good people doing good, non-harming. While it generates something inside of the human being which is precious, there, he says, the teachings of liberation is the teachings of being in touch with the freedom of the movement, the freedom of action, and knowing it so clearly, this is the challenging bit, there are no consequences. There are no consequences. Meaning, not easy one to follow. The meaning here is that consequences, which is fine and can be useful, is I select out of the field of existence and I interpret an event. I call it a consequence. And that we live in a world of causes and consequences, which we've touched upon. Actions and results. Doing something and the fruit of what comes. For a liberated human being, with love and wisdom, does not live in the world of consequences. You could meditate on this for a lifetime, it won't be a waste of time. So there's something so free about life, if one is not selecting out of it and interpreting, not picking out where are the consequences. Life is that free. Enough. Thank you for lending an ear.